The Guardian.
Now, shocking new figures from a range of sources have been published today, revealing the disturbing growth of a two-tier Britain. While some areas of the country are enjoying the fruits of an albeit slow economic recovery, many others are being left behind, leaving their residents jobless and in poverty.
In 2016, the New Policy Institute estimated that 13.5 million people in the UK, that's a fifth of the population, were living in poverty. It's a figure that has barely changed since 2003.
A fifth of the British workers earn less than the living wage.
For this shockingly numerous group, life doesn't get much harder. More than half those in poverty are in working families, but as the price of living continues to rise, ideas of home ownership and other economic safety nets fade from reality.
This is not a list of snacks or treats. This is the entire day's food intake for one child, one hungry child.
For people in poverty, the impact goes far beyond their financial means. Their general health takes a hit too, cutting short their life expectancy. With a slew of recent scientific studies examining this issue, this week we ask, what does poverty do to our health and well-being? And what physiological processes might be at work?
A very clear message came out of the paper that is, after smoking and physical inactivity and diabetes, socioeconomic position is the most important factor that leads to a reduction in life expectancy.
But the other way that we think about it is that there's a relationship between the inflammatory processes and stress processes, and that those relationships mean that over time, chronic stress might be related to the inflammatory responses in some way.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
The purpose of our network is to find a way to transfer scientific evidence into policy.
Yeah.
This is Paolo Vines.
I am professor of environmental epidemiology at Imperial College in London.
Paolo sat down with reporter Nicola Davis in the studio recently, and she started by asking him for a simple definition.
Paolo, to start off with, let's talk about what we mean by socioeconomic status. And is that the best term that we should use when we talk about this issue?
No, it's not the right word. There have been many theories about the classification of individuals according to their socioeconomic conditions. The main theories are the functionalist one, which is based essentially on status or prestige. The other one is mainly based on occupation. In fact, power in society, Weber called the life chances, meaning that depending on your occupation, you have a different power and different chances in society. But then you also have the practical problem of classifying individuals depending on the variables that you have collected in your investigations. So we prefer not to use socioeconomic status, though it is broadly used, and in fact we have used it also in our papers. We prefer the more generic expression, socioeconomic position, because it encompasses different theories.
And so talk me through when we first began to realise that socioeconomic position was linked to health, longevity and this sort of impact.
Well, this is known since a very long time ago. People started showing an interest in this already in the 19th century, at least. So far, we have had mainly descriptive studies showing that mortality, unhealthy aging, functional outcomes differ according to socioeconomic position. But now we need more analytical approaches, which means disentangling what is in socioeconomic position in terms of risk factors, for example, because we know that people in low socioeconomic position smoke more, for example, or they drink more alcohol. So risk factors are entangled together in the concept of socioeconomic position. But recent evidence, for example, from Michael Marmot's group, shows that smoking, alcohol, the usual risk factors for non-communicable diseases do not explain the whole association between socioeconomic position and health or unhealthy aging. There is something more. And probably the main purpose of our research, the network that I lead at European level, is exactly to generate hypotheses on which are the other factors that contribute to the impact of socioeconomic position. Michael Marmot has coined the expression psychosocial factors, for example.
As Paolo mentions, the complex relationship between socioeconomic position and health becomes all the more messy when we include risk factors, such as smoking and alcohol intake. And because of this, trying to disentangle the web is no easy feat.
As you just said, socioeconomic position is so linked to these other health...
Not to be put off, Paolo and his team recently published a study that attempted to do just that.
Well, in the paper we have published earlier this year in The Lancet, we do a very simple exercise that is for about 1.7 million people. We had information on risk factors for non-communicable diseases, which are the usual one, physical inactivity, alcohol, smoking, BMI, diabetes, hypertension. And we also had a good classification of socioeconomic position through occupation of the people. So we tried to look at the impact of the socioeconomic position itself after controlling for the other exposures. It's, if you like, a little rough because we know that all these contribute together and you have synergies and so on. But a very clear message came out of the paper that is after smoking and physical inactivity and diabetes, socioeconomic position is the most important factor that leads to a reduction in life expectancy, which in this case was classified on the basis of occupation and job titles into a simplified three-category ranking. And we found that the number of years of life lost were 2.1 for the comparison between the lowest and the highest category. But as I said, this is a simplified classification. And if you cut the categories more and more into smaller and smaller categories, you will find greater differences, which may go up to 5 or 7 or 8 years if you take the extremes of the distribution.
So in a way, what we're saying is that once you control for the fact that people of a lower socioeconomic position are at higher risk for known risk factors like obesity and smoking and so on, once you take those into account, there's still something else that is caught up in socioeconomic position, which in a way we can use socioeconomic position as almost a proxy, a marker for. But we don't quite know what those are. Is that right?
Exactly, yes. We don't know. Obviously, not only socioeconomic position is a marker or a proxy, but also the observations and the strength of the observations depend on how you cut the categories. What we did was to use a simplified three-level category. But obviously, if you look at the most deprived compared to the least deprived, then the difference in life expectancy is much higher. And you may go up to 5 years, 7 years, 8 years, depending on where you put the border between categories. Now, the next step is to disentangle what is in a socioeconomic position. And our approach is based on biomarkers, as I said. There is already good evidence that certain biomarkers differ by socioeconomic positions. For example, glucocorticoids, cortisol, which is a hormone related to stress. We are looking at the concept of allostatic load, which is basically summary measure of your inflammatory immune reactions. Inflammation is a very general mechanism. For example, it is very strongly related to obesity, in addition to infections, obviously. But it is also related to stress. And then we also look at changes in DNA expression, epigenetics, which means that we want to understand whether this general concept of socioeconomic position has an impact on gene expression and methylation of DNA, modulation of the functioning of the genes. And we have very interesting preliminary data showing that low socioeconomic position is associated with what we call age acceleration, which can be measured through DNA methylation, which is a particular mechanism by which genes are expressed and they are functioning.
And here lies the seriousness of the problem. Those in lower socioeconomic positions are more likely to develop health problems even when all kinds of risk factors are taken into account. It's not just Paolo who hopes to shed light on what might be going on. After this short break, we'll hear from a team at the University of Essex about their approach to the question.
So what we did was we had a look to see if CRP and fibrinogen were associated with these measures of social position and whether that was true across the entire adult age span.
And we'll also hear how the results from these kinds of studies might be put into practice.
Physicians should be aware and should also be able to take socioeconomic position into their decisions concerning therapies.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means and, as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from Paolo Vinaes about his work on the complex relationship between socioeconomic position and life expectancy. We heard about his recent meta-analysis, which found that even when risk factors such as smoking and diabetes are taken into account, one of the biggest determinants of life expectancy is socioeconomic position.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what might be underlying this relationship?
I'm just going to let you know, like the question I'll ask you to start off with, just because...
It's something I put to another scientist hoping to shed more light on the issue.
My name's Mina Kumari, and my title is Professor of Biological and Social Epidemiology, and I'm at the University of Essex.
I sat down with Mina in the studio recently, and I started by asking her...
Mina, before we get to your recent study, for those who don't know, what is systemic inflammation?
Inflammation is kind of our body's reaction to an insult. So if we have an injury, if we cut ourselves or if we have an infection, our body responds to that by activating kind of inflammatory responses. And it's this good thing. You want to deal with an infection or you want to deal with an injury appropriately. What happens over time is if you keep having those insults or if you keep making that inflammatory response, over time, it's not good for us. And what we're interested in is thinking about the effects of this chronic inflammatory process, this sort of long-term systemic inflammatory process. So when we talk about systemic inflammation, that's what we're talking about.
So this is inflammation that is throughout the body. Do we know anything about the effects it can have on the body? What does it do to us?
So if you think about what happens to you when you have an infection, a cold, say, you have a high temperature, you don't feel so good, you want to stay at home, you want to go to bed, you want to go to sleep, those kind of things. If you have that, but at a very low level all the time, you might not notice that you're not functioning so well, but you might be more tired, you might be not functioning so well. And so over time, systemic inflammation might be related to those things, and that's the sort of thing that we're interested in investigating and thinking about.
What actually causes systemic inflammation and what role might there be for socioeconomic position?
In terms of chronic inflammation and chronic processes that we're interested in. What we think could happen is that you have these appropriate responses to something, an infection or something else, and that's fine. But over time, the relationship between the kind of the impacts of these things on your body change, so that you're constantly perhaps making an inflammatory response, or you're constantly having kind of raised levels of your inflammatory markers. Often when we think about social position, what we're hypothesizing is, well, there could be lots of different ways by which social position might be related to these processes. One is that maybe you are experiencing lots of things that cause you to have an inflammatory response. Maybe if you're living in poor housing and it's moldy or something like that, or you're breathing in things that are irritating or activating an inflammatory response, pollutants or something like that. That could be one way. But the other way that we think about it is that there's a relationship between the inflammatory processes and stress processes, and that those relationships mean that over time, chronic stress might be related to the inflammatory responses in some way, so that you've got kind of raised levels in the inflammatory markers and due to a kind of chronically stressed.
As Paolo mentioned earlier, this relationship between stress and inflammation is receiving plenty of attention from scientists in the field. And it's stress that Mina and her colleagues turned to in a recent study that was published in the journal Scientific Reports this year. They looked at what specific biomarkers might tell us about socioeconomic position, stress, and overall health. But what biomarkers did they target and why?
So we were particularly interested in that relationship between social position and these inflammatory markers. And what we picked were inflammatory markers that we could measure in a large number of people. So some of these inflammatory markers are difficult to measure in a large number of people. The ones we picked were the ones that kind of gave us an idea of the general systemic inflammation. And so we measured something called C-reactive protein. It kind of captures kind of the inflammatory load in the body. And then we also measured something called fibrinogen, which captures inflammation, but it also has other properties. So it's involved in blood clotting and that kind of thing. So we measured two different inflammatory markers because they're easiest to measure in a large number of people.
So these other two markers, they're easier to do. They're probably more reliable for a study like this. Going into your study, what did you hope to find? What was your starting hypothesis, if you like?
There is already some evidence that C-reactive protein is raised in people who experience more disadvantage. So we have done lots of work in kind of older age group populations where we can see that if you are more disadvantaged by social class, say, or occupation or something like that, then you have raised levels of CRP. The thing is, when people are older, they'll have experienced lots of things, and it might be related to other things like their own health. So we wanted to have a look at these two markers in a population where we've collected blood samples from across the entire adult age range. And the study that I work with, it's called Understanding Society, it's the UK Household Longitudinal Study, has taken a blood sample from nearly 13,000 people and their age from 16 to 100. And so we could look to see, and we've got really detailed measures of their social position. So we could look to see what their CRP and fibrinogen levels were like with those measures. But we could do it across the entire adult age span. And we were interested in doing that because there is some suggestion that in much younger age groups, you don't see these differences yet. And I was quite interested to see when do we start seeing them? So what we did was we had a look to see if CRP and fibrinogen were associated with these measures of social position, and whether that was true across the entire adult age span. And what we found was that these differences emerged in people in their sort of 30s, and they got bigger and bigger, the differences between the most advantaged and the most disadvantaged people, until you kind of got into your 50s, and then they came together again in the oldest age groups. So that was quite interesting to us because we're not sure what that's about, and we've got lots of work to do to think about what that might be about.
So the levels of both of these biomarkers go up in everybody as they age, but they go up more rapidly
in that's right.
people with from a lower socioeconomic position?
That's exactly right. So CRP in particular is in people who are interested in aging and interested in inflammation. There's a kind of inflammaging theory around how important the inflammatory processes are in terms of aging processes. And what happens is, yes, as you get older, these biomarkers kind of increase just normally in everyone. And what we see is that they're increasing in those people who are more advantaged, but yeah, less so, less rapidly than those people who are more disadvantaged. And you can start seeing kind of significant, statistically significant differences in people in their 30s.
What do you think might explain the difference here that you see across the ages between these two groups?
There are lots of theories about why health is different in more advantaged versus less advantaged people. It might be that, you know, they're kind of material things. I talked about housing earlier on. So it might be that you're just living in an environment that's poorer for the systemic inflammation. It might be that life's kind of a bit more stressful for people who are in kind of more disadvantaged environments. We looked at the usual suspects when we're thinking about these sorts of things. So are people who have more in more disadvantaged circumstances, do they do things in response to that, like smoke more or drink more or, you know, eat poorer diets? And we sort of try to adjust for that statistically, and that didn't explain the differences particularly. Well, it didn't, they were still there. So we then have to sort of think about, well, is it something about the stressful nature of the environment? That's something else that we can investigate. Why do these differences kind of happen in the 30s? Is it something to do with work? It could be. And those are the sorts of things that we can think about looking at and investigating further. And one of the nice things about the study, the Understanding Society study, is that we have measured some of those things. We know lots about occupation. We know the sorts of jobs that people do. So we're quite lucky in that we've got all these biological markers in this kind of social data set, which has got really detailed measures of people's experiences and environments, that kind of thing. So we can do that in more detail.
So stress provides a convincing link between socioeconomic position and health. But the relationship between the two will, of course, be complex and nuanced. I wanted to know whether other systems beyond inflammation might be at play too.
We are interested in other biological pathways. So there's a whole metabolic profile or metabolic system if you're interested in diabetes or that kind of thing. Diabetes is also socially patterned. So there are other pathways that we are interested in looking at, and we do look at. We wanted to look at CRP here because of this aging thing, because we have data from across the entire adult age span. So we have better diagrams, as it were, between social position and health. And we know that there are certain pathways that we think are important or not. In terms of CRPS, we're measuring something that's easy to measure in large numbers of people. The other inflammatory markers that we might be interested in measuring, something called interleukin-6, for example, is quite interesting. But it's difficult to measure in very large scale, because one of the things that we do in our study is that because we're interested in making sure that we've got people across the entire social spectrum, that we've got difficult to reach people and kind of easier to reach people, as it were, is that we go into a participant's home and we collect the blood sample there. It means that we can't process it straight away, and these other biomarkers that we might be interested in measuring aren't robust to that kind of sample collection, so we have to use ones that are, like CRP and fibrinogen. But it means that we've got everyone, so it means that in our study we've got people who are unemployed or don't have very much money or find it difficult to come to a clinic and that kind of thing. So we know that we've got a good representative sample. And so in terms of methods, we can't always measure everything that we want to.
In Norwich, this lunch club run by volunteers like Lisa is a lifeline for families struggling to feed their children during the long and expensive summer holidays.
It's good that we're here, but we shouldn't be here. In a country like the UK, we shouldn't be here.
The hope then for Mina, Paolo and other scientists in the field is to create a clearer picture of what is going on, piece by piece.
Sometimes we don't have lunch.
We run out of bread and stuff to go in the sandwiches. So if we don't...
Now, obviously, the policy implications for these kinds of studies are huge.
The hope is they will eventually form the basis of a new approach to healthcare in the UK and further afield.
Very final one, if I can. What would you hope ultimately?
Before then, how might the results from these studies be used?
So they help us understand why are there sort of these social differences in health? What's the biology? What's the underlying processes that are happening? One of the things we want to do is measure these biomarkers again. So as the social environment's changing, we'd like to see, is that having an impact on people's underlying biology? One of the things about getting people's underlying biology rather than do you go to the doctor or what, you know, has a doctor told you you've ever been ill, is that you get an idea of what might be coming down the road. If these biomarkers are helping us understand kind of underlying health that people don't know about, then we can sort of understand what might be happening in 5 years time in terms of, is there a change in people's health that's going to happen in a few years time when things become overt and that kind of thing. So it helps you get an idea of something called the clinical iceberg. So is there lots of stuff that we don't know about yet that we need to know about in the future? So it sort of helps you with all of that, and it helps you understand really as the environment's changing, as the social situation is changing, as the world's changing, how is that actually impacting people's biology, and what does that mean for us as we through time.
And given that there are people who already are in certain socioeconomic positions, we can't change it overnight, no matter how much we might want to. Does this mean that when people present with certain health problems, their socioeconomic position should be taken into account by healthcare providers in order to make sure that they're given the best care?
Oh, yes, that's a very good comment, because this is one of our suggestions for policymakers. In fact, socioeconomic position, and Michael Marmot says that all the time, should be included in all policies and also in many practical actions and interventions. For example, physicians should be aware and should also be able to take socioeconomic position into their decisions concerning therapies. Because people belonging to low socioeconomic position groups may have specific needs.
Special thanks this week to Paolo Vinace and Mina Kamari. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to a recent article written by Kat Arney in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Great podcasts from The Guardian. Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.